Well, hello there, Mayu. How are you?
Hi, Stephanie. Lovely to meet you.
Very,
I'm okay.
Very happy to meet you. I love your work in House of David. Love it.
Oh, thank you. Amazing.
I'm
very proud.
I love and appreciate costume design and what goes into it, particularly in a period piece like this, where fabrications, the fabrics are so important, the embellishments, the threads that you use, the metallic threads, the aging and distressing, all of this tells us who
amazing.
all of these things tell us who each of these people are, who the tribes are, who the armies are, who's on which side of which army.
Indeed.
Right down, I mean, the minutiae and the attention to detail here. This is actually something quite similar to what Kevin Costner has done with his epic three-part series about the Old West and settling the West. Everything here, I look at this and I see the shepherds and I see the fabric. And you can see the weave of the fabric, which is something that would have been present in 1000 BC. And it's also the same color as the sand, as the mountains, so that the people can meld into it, so you're not as vulnerable to an outside attack from another one of the 12 tribes of Israel.
They're amazing. Like, it's so brilliant to see costume appreciated, not because it's mine. I'm just saying, like, costume in general appreciated and brought to the forefront. It's very important. Like, it warms my heart that you see all these details and that people see all these details. I think costume is not appreciated enough.
People appreciate costume when it stands out, when it's a period piece, something. Oh, you know, like Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, which it's bubblegum satin. Or if it's, you know, even back in MGM when they did their own Marie Antoinette with Norma Shearer and those massive costumes, they didn't have color. They had black and white grayscale to work with. So there was so much embellishment and ruffles and laces that went into play. So costume is, it speaks very loudly in so many kinds of stories, and particularly a period piece like this. And what amazes me is because 1000 BC, it's not like you can just walk in the library and pick up a picture book and say, oh, this is what it looked like. Oh, this is what they were wearing. This requires a lot of research and going down the rabbit hole, even going back and reading the Bible, the Old Testament of the Bible, where it describes sandals or things that people are wearing. So
Indeed. This
is such a massive undertaking, and to see the authenticity come to life here, I am in love with your work here.
It's brilliant. I'm so pleased. And I mean, yes, that not having so much to research. actually, there was quite a lot to research, and also at the same time, all the gaps that exist are in a way a blessing, because it kind of feeds the artistic license. So it's a twofold, isn't it?
Like, yeah.
I mean, we didn't leave any stone unturned when it came to research, but at the same time, seeing everything and researching everything, that's kind of a safety cushion and a springboard, so we can actually be more imaginative and create a show, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, and something that I see influences, I see Greek and Egyptian influences come into a lot of what you have designed, especially when we're looking at King Saul and his queen and his daughters, Michal and Merab. We really get to see the influences there, especially when it comes to the jewelry and the use of color, which, of course, sets King Saul in his court and his royal status apart from everybody else, especially the shepherds that we have already come to know quite well from what we, from a lot of just stunning visuals. Not a lot, don't need a lot of dialogue to establish who the shepherds are. But that's where I really see the Greek and the Egyptian influence, especially when we get into the queen's jewelry with Mikhail's jewelry. Absolutely gorgeous. I want some of those pieces.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was about, in the research, we expanded so much. It was actually studying the world and how it worked in 1000 BC rather than just being very geographic specific. We explored trade routes or the way the Philistines had come from Greece and Crete in order to establish themselves in the coast next to the Israel tribe. So all this feeds into the hows and the decisions that we could make for dressing them or giving them accessories, or the particular, as you said, the particular fabrics, if they were coming from Egypt, all the way from China, for example.
Anybody that knows their Bible or even parts of it, you know, you've got the 12 tribes of Israel and they're scattered everywhere. Of course, with Moses, they're leaving Egypt. So there's a lot of Egyptian iconography and fashion that's, and influence is going to come with them as they go into the desert and expand throughout the land. That really comes to play here. And I notice when you're setting apart, particularly Saul's court with the Philistine court of King Achish, your color differential. Achish is always, he's silver. Silver and blue are his signature colors. You've got beautiful metallic threads, and that picks up the color scheme from Greece and Crete that has been part of their heritage for centuries.
Oh my God, you're amazing. For like, I'm so happy that you read that, think that, because that was part of, yes, that was the thinking. And also the fact that the Philistines also had, they were the first to have iron, which they were keeping through trade routes so that the Israelites would not get it. Mm-hmm. And that's how they forged this amazing new sword for Goliath, mm-hmm. and part of his armor. So that's where all the silver comes. And again, as you said, like the blues and hints of yellow and grays.
Yeah.
It comes from like the coastal journey, really.
Yeah.
And that's why their army also, I think the army came first with a bit of an artistic license that it went into the gray hues and grays and gray browns rather than the more historically accurate. I think that's an artistic license there.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, always the gamble is to take the artistic license but make it believable, and first and foremost make the vision and the image readable to the audience so they can see the battles and they can read.
I think with the Philistines, with Achish, and the armies, his armies in particular, because they have come from Greece and Crete, island areas, water, you're going to be influenced more by the bluish-gray colors.
Yes, some of them as well have sort of netted capes as well, which kind of allude. I mean, it's not always just beautiful, but it's also alludes a little bit to that as well.
The differential, and then you look at Saul and the Israelites, and they pretty much have been just a desert people. So their color scheme comes from the colors of the earth. The reds, you can grind that from the umbers of flowers or from rocky cliffs and mountains. The greens, obviously, from trees. So we see all that, and it's so stunning to see the differentials of the characters and the people as a whole.
It's definitely more earthy, Israelites. And one of the first things that I remember Erwin telling me was that there is a big chunk of the Israelite army that is not actually army. It's actually people fighting.
Yep.
So it's not that everybody will be on full on armor. So the Israelite army, as opposed to the Philistine army, has a bit of a gradient in how much weaponry or how much armor they have. And also the army becomes more earthy as well.
You can see, especially as we get into the climactic, the final two episodes and the battles in episodes 7 and 8, David and Goliath, which I've seen the whole series. But you see, they're picking up pitchforks and wooden rakes and lesser, not nice, fancy swords like the Philistines, but they're picking up anything. David picks up a rock. So they don't have money. They're just, the earth is behind them. That whole idea of God, creation, the earth, the natural elements, that's what defines them, not opulence.
Very, very evident in the border village.
Yes.
In the very beginning, when they, when they knew that they were fighting the giants, or they were attacked by the giants, and it's kind of the same. It's just a village.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a border village. That's the only.
That's
the only
it.
Downfall.
Yeah.
So it's just as you say, shepherds and people that work the earth. They're not fighters.
How did you even start to approach this project, Maya? Uh-huh. Because this is just such a massive undertaking. As I'm watching this with all the background extras, all the principals, I couldn't help but think Julian Day, who I adore Julian beyond belief. He did over 10,000 costumes for Bohemian Rhapsody. And I'm looking and I'm like, okay, this is on par with what Julian did, if not more.
There's a lot of costumes, yes. That was one of the challenges. And I mean, the way to do it is to actually have a great team, mm-hmm. I think, first and foremost. A great team that can take the research even further and that you also trust their brains and their eyes and their work ethics. So it was very early on that I contacted a bunch of people in order to see if this is achievable even. You know, it's like, it's amazing to get an opportunity like this, but you also need to see if you've got your team behind you,
mm-hmm.
And if your team is available.
Mm-hmm.
Having Sandra as the head of background acting and Mariana as the head of the costume armory, that's just made a huge difference to build a trust. I mean, and neither one of those women I had worked with before, to be honest, I knew them and I wanted to work with them. It was a soft crack built of trust, I think. And along with my associate designer, Katerina, it was visits to big costume warehouses and actually world building. Like, I remember we went to Paris in Spain and we started just building mannequins and world building on the spot, to explore the possibilities as well. At the same time, I was just flying everywhere, picking up fabrics with my assistant in London, Rosie. So it was a multitasking, definitely. And trusting, I think, the safety net of the research and the gut feeling of what's right.
Mm-hmm.
And also making some rules of, yes, it's only going to be natural fibers. It's only going to be hand stitching. what kind of embroidery it's going to be. These were sort of basic rules that cannot, in inverted commas, cannot be broken.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the first and best experiences was actually picking fabrics and also building lots of clothes rails in big tires, just to see the possibilities. I think communication is key, and I always love sending lots of different things to the director producers. So it was at that point that I started sending what I finally call my little podcast of rails, fabrics, and color schemes, and you know, going, you know, I've put these fabrics together, and that's kind of this world, or these types of embroidery, or look at these mannequins we've put together in costume hire, and this is kind of the population of this city. And it starts being fleshed out, and that also gives you grounding, and I think it spurs you on, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know,
as the population, we begin to see it, and that's where it comes to trust with the main people that I chose as heads of departments, is that they recognize the tribes, and they recognize the different rules that we've set, and the color rules and the fabric rules, and it just becomes a second nature in a way. It becomes, Katerina put it really, really beautifully the other week. She said, you know, we have a vocabulary of how to do things, from different patterns of tunics to colors or stitching. It's a whole vocabulary of House of David costumes.
Mm-hmm. Now, something that I love, the whole hand stitching, and I have to commend you, because as I'm watching, I was so thrilled to not see finished edges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing was rolled over for a hem stitch or anything like that. We see the fabric edging. We see, especially with muslin or burlap and cottons, with the shepherds in particular, you can see that. I am so tickled that you went with the hand stitch, and with certain tunics where you might have done pleats and stitched them down, you've done it folding and then just wrapping a sash around it. Brilliant.
Yeah. There's a massive amount of draping, and also with the edges, I mean, one of our favorites as well is when the fabrics had really beautiful salvages, to use that as well, and sometimes even put a trim and use the salvage, because it's part of the journey. One of my personal favorite stories within, like an Easter egg in a way, is the way some children were constructed, with a sense of they were passed down costume. They were passed down costume from brothers, sisters,
sure,
or other family, and they kept growing. So there's this sense of fabrics that have been joined up
mm-hmm.
in order to accommodate the growth of a child. And equally, I think that's with young David, yes it is, that his tunic is taken up, but
yeah,
it's folded within itself in,
mm-hmm.
in the design to accommodate, like, as if it was a hand down that was too long for him, but obviously it was not shortened. It was just taken up in order to let loose again as he was growing. So it's little things like that became, again, part of the vocabulary,
mm-hmm.
as I said.
I was so tickled to see all of that, because I'm looking, and no, there's not stitching. You are just using sashes to pull things up. You're letting the raw edges be there. I'm glad you mentioned the selvage on a lot of these fabrics,
mm-hmm.
because as you said, I worked in fabric and have sewn for many, 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 many years. I used to make all my own clothes at one point.
Well, incredible.
and the selvages, some of them really are beautiful. And I was wondering that, especially when looking at the queen and some of the trim, like on the blue gown that she wears, and you got that beautiful embroidered trim, and it looks almost like it could have been an edge on another fabric that was tied together there. But some of the cleaner finishes are on her clothes, on Mikhail's clothes. I love the flowiness that you give to the romantic aspect of Mikhail. And you've got layers of very thin, almost like a voile, a cotton voile, or actually a cotton chiffon weight that is just tied with a sash. And then you've embellished it with tiny little gold beads and things. But I love to see that differential in the finishing of the garment, because that also speaks to who these people are. And then you get into your leathers as breastplates and things like that for those that can't afford bronze breastplates. But the leather work then is another whole thing. I mean, everywhere I look, there's something else.
Most of the leather was made in Spain. And of course, I mean, there's a lot of breastplates that were hired as well. Lots of the breastplates were made in Spain, as well as Goliath as well. And then taken further in the workshops, in our workshops, with prop armory, costume armory, pulling together. And enhancing them really, and making even more pieces for the armies. I think the whole of the Philistine army was constructed in Spain.
Wow.
Yeah, we were all over the world.
That did
as well as engaging local leather makers and jewelers and local artisans as well in Greece, where it was being shot. We did fly everywhere for fabrics and for make.
Now, I'm curious, Maya, did you also, because the crowns are very different. We look at Saul, and he has hammered gold as his crowns, and he has more than one crown. We look at Achish, head of the Philistines, and he has a silver crown, but it's a totally different kind of design on filigree and design on there. Did you design the crowns as well as a lot of these necklaces and the earrings that are being worn?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I mean, again, some of the crowns were hired or they were altered. But yeah, like Saul and Achish and Agag, and like every hero one that was also made more than one time for different reasons. And as you said, yes, Saul had his battle crown and his state crown.
Yes.
As well. They were made by local artisans as well. Yeah.
I love the hammered gold of Saul's crowns, because you can actually see the hammering in that gold. It's the fingerprint. It's that idea of the handmade fingerprint on everything. And
we were really happy with that make, indeed.
Oh, my God. Now, you've also got a lot of aging and distressing happening here because of the hand-me-down aspect. How time-consuming was that? Because you have all these background players that have a lot more aging and distressing happening in their clothes. So I'm curious about the challenges and the time involved in that.
Indeed. I mean, I love aging and breakdown. It's kind of breathing life into the costume. It's not just aging and breakdown. The aging, breakdown, and dying department, headed by Krisa Serdari, it did an amazing job, but they were also dyeing. So they were also dyeing the fabrics. So it was a world of lots of fabric dye samples, lots of aging samples. They had a wall full of wounds, of different wounds that we could go back and use as a reference for different weapons or lion bites or anything like that. And some of the aging team was on set, especially with battles, with anything that needed blood, needs a vet killing by the lion, all this. There were actual aging and breakdown people on set as well to help facilitate all that as well.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Now, I love, there is one signature piece in this whole series that just stands out for me, and that is Samuel's scarf. That is so important and so defining to Samuel, because I think a lot of people may not remember or know who Samuel was. You know, he was a prophet, he was the last judge, he's the one that anointed Saul as the first king and anointed David, unbeknownst to so many at this point in the series. But that scarf, it's almost the equivalent of like Moses and his staff. You don't see him without it.
True. I had nicknamed it the relic. because I think the story behind it from John Irwin and John Gunn was that it was handed down from his mother, so it obviously had to be an older piece, hence the nickname the relic. I think within that I had to have a tiny bit of David's blue. And lots of fraying and lots of embroidery in the sense of storytelling, in the sense of it was embroidery that was done from time to time rather than one undertaking of let's embroider this scarf. So it had little instances of embroidery on it. Yeah, it's one of my favorite pieces as well.
Did you keep it for yourself?
I really want to. I would gladly put it on the wall. I mean, it was one of those things that when I was designing it, I knew it was going to be a challenge across the board to find the fabric, the right fabrics. To age it the right way. I was so impressed by the way the department translated it, the making department and the embroiderers and the aging department. I was really impressed and so happy. I remember at some point picking up two fabrics going, this is it, these are the fabrics. And the rest was turning to magic. So that was fantastic.
You worked a lot of magic, turning a lot of things into beautiful, beautiful garments that define the era, that define this situation. It just absolutely outstanding on every level. Now, I'm curious. You're doing all this hand stitching. Did you go so far down the rabbit hole that you actually found bone needles that would have been used at that point in time in history? Or did you sacrifice and use modern day needles for your hand stitching?
I'll take the stitch. No, No, that wasn't modern.
Yeah, well, as deep as you're digging in and as authentic as you're being, you very well could have. I would not have been surprised if you told me yes, that you did.
No, it was part of the research, no doubt. one of the first things that I had done when we started with the department, we had two or three different locations for the costume department, one of them being my office in London, and then two big spaces in Greece. We printed all of the research, all of the images.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the research is also filtered because we're using more stuff and we are prioritizing filtering all the information. So and also building the colors of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we just put everything on the walls. So about 200-300 square meters of the first location that we had was all wallpapered with costumes, research, designs, sketches, information, color schemes, mood boards, everything. Different walls were different tribes or different peoples or armies and commoners or royals. It was one of those things, like a kind of laugh, saying, okay, everybody, even new people joining the costume department have no excuse not knowing the information. It's everywhere. You're seeing it everywhere. I think in that sense, everybody, and then it was just a pleasure to see that people kept adding things to it as well. Different types of stitching, like there was a wall in the making room with different types of stitching. I remember lots of pictures of the subligaculum, which is the ancient underwear that Sandra Sotiriou had put in the background section of behind her office. It was just different ways of tying subligaculums and turbans and headscarves. So again, that's a part of the vocabulary, but it's just a joy, really.
Now, out of all the worlds that you created here within House of David, do you have a favorite one? Is it Philistines? Is it the giants? Is it Saul and his court? Is it the shepherds? Do you have a favorite world that you created?
No, favorite world. No, I think the actual world of House of David is my favorite. Like every single bit of it. I'm very pleased in the way all the world within that world fits in. So I can't actually pick one. It's one world, and that's the House of David one.
And it's an incredible world. Now, you did the footwear also, did you not?
Yes. So many shoes, so much leather, and so many tricks. For making them comfortable, so many outdoor shooting in many, many different weather conditions as well. The shoe section of the department is a massive undertaking on its own.
There's climbing, a lot of rock climbing happening here. A lot of rock climbing happening. That is not easy on shoes, on footwear.
No, and it's not easy to cheat better soles for the shoes as well. So that's why there were lots of different tricks and cheats to make them, especially for the principal actors, to make them comfortable to ride horses and run and be on rocks and on rocky ground and on mud, but also going completely ruin their feet. Really.
Yeah.
Lots of conversations during fittings with them.
Something that's very interesting is that while we do have our defining color palettes for our different worlds within the world. I love that you also got a chance to bring in black and darkness through two characters, through the witch and through the lunatic. I call him a lunatic, the murderer who likes to kill animals.
He's a black character. He is defined by the color black. He's like the shadow in the palace. Because he is somewhere in the dungeons of Saul's palace. Also the antithesis of... it was one of the first things that came to me for the mother of the giants, that she's more bright.
Mm-hmm.
When I was reading the script, I think that came only from reading the script rather than anything else. And the way I saw Akish walking into that cavernous lair of the giant, and then this is like a little white blob that becomes Orpah, the witch mother. So to me, she was a bright thing in the darkness. Hence it was she's dressed more in off-white and her white hair and of course very aged garments, but still she's the whitest I think we've had. In a clear way,
she looks very ethereal between the costume and her hair. She actually looks very ethereal. And when she steps out of the little cart that Goliath has towed her in to bring her to Akish at his suburban palace, and she steps out and there's that sunlight behind her, you really get a very ethereal lightness to her. And it just looks, it is a beautiful contrast to some of the other elements and stands out. Even against the earthy tones and the sandy colors of shepherds and things like that, she really stands out all by herself, as does Evil and a sorceress.
Yeah, I mean, she's human, but at the same time, she gave birth to a bunch of giants.
Yeah.
There has to be that kind of uncertainty about who she is and what exactly she is. It's, I think, part of the world building and the storytelling. She's a bit mythical in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what happens when you mess around with archangels who get sent down to hell.
Exactly.
These are the things that happen. Oh my God. Now, are you going to continue doing costuming for season two?
Yes, we're shooting season two as we speak. So, the saga continues. And, it's bigger and better, I think.
I don't know how much bigger it can get, to be honest with you. This is pretty darn big. I'm hoping in season two that we do get to see David take the crown. I'm hoping for that. I'm sure they are. But story-wise, if you follow the Bible and you go through the progression, I'm hoping that we do get to see David fulfill his destiny from God and actually take the crown. Because who knows how much longer Saul's going to be around. He ain't doing too good. This whole production, it is so fantastic, Mayu. Just amazing.
Oh, brilliant.
I can't believe that you were gutsy enough when they gave you this to say, oh yeah, I'll do it.
it might sound gutsy. I'm quite the opposite. I've never taken on anything that I wasn't feeling it 100%. In all my life, if I was not certain that one, I'm gonna love the creativity of it, the creative side of it, and two, that I can actually do it, I had never I've never challenged myself in the sense of, I'm not sure if I can actually do it, but let's try. If that makes sense. So, it is gutsy. At the same time, again, it's part of the, before I even said yes, I started researching. Mm-hmm. I needed to see if I was in love with the material, in love with the creativity that it can bring. During all the talks with the producers and the creatives, and before we even locked anything, I was researching, I was doing some sketches. And as I said in the very beginning, I was making some phone calls going, you know, guys, are you with me? Can I have some people that I've worked with before and I know I can communicate, and also they know me. It's not just me knowing these people, it's these people knowing me as well, and mm-hmm. and all my quirks and all my good sides and my bad sides as well. And it was a joy that they said, oh my God, yes, we're with you.
I'm so thrilled that you have not only tackled this project, but you have mastered it.
Oh, thank you.
It is so beautiful. It is so historical. There is so much authenticity here. And I'm beyond impressed with your work. Beyond impressed. And I can't wait to see season two.
Yes. Oh, yes. I can't wait for it to come out. It seems it's too far away. But, I just can't wait. With the reaction that I've seen for season one, which is just heartwarming, really, to know that, you know, all these efforts and all these stories you want to tell, they actually, they're being loved right now.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
And anything that is rooted in the Bible is always, that's dicey as to how people are if they're going to gravitate towards it or not. It doesn't matter how well the production is done, but because of the religious tie-in and the history, there are so many people that won't even give it a shot.
Yeah, that's very true. But I mean, I think that's where the way that the story is told, I don't feel it's preaching or anything like that. It's a story.
Yeah.
It's a hero story. Somebody said the biblical Game of Thrones. Right? it's first and foremost a hero story.
It truly is. And it's just like if you were picking up a history book and reading it.
Yeah.
Only it looks much better. It looks much better than a history book. So,
yay.
Maya, this has been wonderful getting to talk with you about House of David Season 1. I hope I get to talk to you again about Season 2.
Amazing. Looking forward to it. I hope we meet again.
I hope so. Thank you so much. And you go have a wonderful, I think it's pushing evening in London where you are.
Yeah.
Well,
it's almost 6 o'clock.
And
good morning to you.
And happy weekend to you.
Absolutely. Happy weekend.
Thanks, Mayu. And sooner rather than later, we'll chat again.
Yes, please.
Bye-bye.